Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump using the Easter break, on the eve of which the redacted Mueller report was released, to pound on the theme of no collusion, while the Democrats in recess remained largely silent as they wrestled with whether or not to utter the I word, impeachment. Alan Lichtman, a political historian at American University who has studied both the American right and the presidency and is the author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, joins us to discuss the contrast between Trump's fact-free victory lap and the apparent inability of the Democrats to get the damning facts out, which are in the Mueller report in spite of Barr's redactions. We'll assess the greater danger of avoiding even bringing up impeachment for fear it will backfire, if the lack of a response from the Democrats means they are caving in out of caution and in doing so are letting the absurd, self-serving Trump narrative stand, essentially validating his disastrous presidency and serial criminality. Furthermore, in misreading the lessons from the Clinton impeachment, Democrats are losing sight of what a trial in the Republican-controlled Senate would reveal to the public, as Trump's enablers would be forced to defend the indefensible, as damaging evidence from the Mueller report and subsequent investigations piles on. Then we'll get an update on the fine print in the Mueller report from Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at mtwheel.net and serves on the advisory committee for the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. She joins us to discuss how the 14 ongoing investigations, 12 of which are secret, that have been referred by Mueller will add more to the case against Trump, which will eventually reach the heartland and add to the growing movement for impeachment. Then finally, we'll examine the links to foreign terrorist networks emerging from the suicide bombing attacks in Sri Lanka that killed 300 and wounded over 500, and speak with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. He joins us to discuss how intelligence provided by India warning of an impending attack was not shared among top officials and the possibility that Christians and Westerners were targeted in revenge for the recent massacres of Muslims at the mosques in New Zealand. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian, teaches at American University, and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election, when against all odds he predicted a Trump victory. The author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, his latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk about the case for impeachment, because at this point, money is pouring into the re-elect Trump campaign. Barr has done such a clever job of spinning this report and creating the public perceptions, which Trump has seized upon and out there chanting, no collusion, no collusion. And of course, they dumped it on the Easter Passover weekend where the Democrats were out of town. They seem to be caught flat-footed. And now there's a sort of debate going on within the Democratic caucus about whether or not to even talk about impeachment. Well, if you let Trump's narrative stand that he's been exonerated, aren't you then just simply accepting his narrative that this was no big deal, nothing was found? You might as well just tear up the Mueller report if that's your attitude. I'm astounded that they don't understand that this is the time to let the public know about what's actually in the Mueller report, as opposed to run for the hills afraid of the I word.
Democrats always seem to be playing not to lose, and that is a surefire way to lose. We saw that in 2016. Barack Obama should have given an Oval Office address, not just on the Russians' attempt to rig our election, but their attempt to rig it on behalf of Donald Trump. Why didn't he do it? Because he said, ha ha, you know, I couldn't get Mitch McConnell to go along with me to make it bipartisan, as if there was a one in a million chance that Mitch McConnell would ever agree to that. He didn't need Mitch McConnell. He was the president of the United States. And we're now seeing the same diffidence on the part of Democrats, and they are misreading the politics completely. First of all, as you say, if they don't at least begin an impeachment inquiry against Donald Trump, he will not only have gotten away scot-free with no consequences, but he will now be empowered moving forward to do anything he wants, to undermine the Constitution, to destroy the rule of law, to punish his enemies like Vladimir Putin without fear of retribution. But even on hard politics, the Democrats are wrong. They think that the impeachment of Bill Clinton hurt the Republicans. Nonsense. Yes, the Republicans may have lost a few seats in Congress, but they held on to the Congress, and they got a huge prize, the presidency in 2000. Because of the impeachment, the Democrats wouldn't even let Bill Clinton, by far and away their best campaigner, out on the trail. Are you telling me that if Bill Clinton had campaigned in Florida, he couldn't have turned 537 votes to Al Gore? That was the margin by which George W. Bush won. Finally, the Democrats think that scattered investigations in lots of different committees can be a substitute for an impeachment inquiry. That's wrong. Only an impeachment inquiry has focus, brings everything together, and has the formality of a constitutional process. They had lots of scattered things against Donald Trump in 2016, even the Access Hollywood tape in which he bragged about assaulting women, and it did not work. Finally, put aside the Mueller report. Even if there was no Mueller report, there are ample other grounds to begin an impeachment inquiry. The Southern District of New York said they have clear and convincing evidence that Donald Trump directed Michael Cohen to commit two serious felonies, high crimes, violations of the campaign finance laws, which are designed to protect our democracy. And then there is the New York Times report detailing all kinds of shady financial dealings. And, of course, there is the clear violation of the emoluments clauses of the Constitution, which say a president can't take anything of value from a foreign power or their entities or from domestic governments. And then, of course, there is the gross abuse of presidential power in so many ways.
Well, already, of course, Donald Trump is flexing his muscles because he's now suing to block the House subpoena of his finance records from Elijah Cummings' investigation. So, I mean, let's just pull back for a minute, Alan. Basically, he's saying, I'm above the law. I'm not going to give you my taxes.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to give you my financial records.
Too spineless to do anything about it.
Right.
Kicking sand in their face, and they're just lying down and taking it so far. In a sense, the Democrats are worse enablers than Donald Trump than the Republicans. At least the Republicans have a political reason to be enablers of Donald Trump, as immoral, un-American as it may be. Democrats have no reason to be enablers of Donald Trump, except their own lack of courage.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian, teaches at American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. He's the author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, and his latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. But one of the other aspects of this fear of impeachment and the misreading of what happened with Clinton, they always say, the Democrats always say, well, you know, with Mitch McConnell there, of course, as you pointed out, Alan, they're not going to, you know, the House makes the case and the Senate votes, and you have to have a two-thirds majority to convict in the Senate, and that would never happen in Mitch McConnell's Senate. But what you would be doing, though, is that you'd be putting all of those Republicans on the record, and they'd have to defend the indefensible. I mean, there's only one of them that's had the courage to speak out, Mitt Romney, to point out how disgusting Trump is. It's all there in the Mueller report, even the redacted version. It's clear.
You're absolutely right. Not only do they put them on record, you have to have a trial. And they can, you know, bring out all of this in the trial and force whoever it is who will be defending Donald Trump to defend the indefensible. And the American people will be riveted on the trial. There's another misreading of history, and that's the misreading of the Nixon impeachment. Of course, he resigned before the full House could impeach him, but the Judiciary Committee voted three articles of impeachment. And the notion is it was only the tapes that doomed Nixon. Nonsense. He was doomed before the smoking gun came out. What doomed him? All of the public testimony. And an impeachment inquiry and a trial will rivet the American people on, I think, equally damning, maybe even more damning, public testimony than in the Nixon case. But without that kind of focus, you're not going to pin anything on President Trump, and you're just going to let him get away with it.
Well, even in the report that we've seen, the fact that when he first learned of that there's a special counsel being appointed, he slumped back in his chair and basically said, "My presidency is over. I'm effed." That's literally from the horse's mouth. I mean, I don't know. I don't watch Fox because I don't want to inflict any unnecessary injury upon myself. But
right, you want to preserve your health.
Right, but how are they spinning that? That seems pretty obvious that the man himself knew that if there was a real investigation of him, his presidency would be over. And you have to hand it to the Republicans. They've done a hell of a job of coming to his defense, particularly Barr, and spinning it and framing it for the public in a way that...
Exactly. Yeah. Barr is the most treacherous attorney general in history. Yes, a sitting attorney general, Richard Kleindienst, pled guilty to a misdemeanor because he misled Congress on a peripheral issue in Watergate. And Kleindienst was not the sharpest tool in the draw. Barr knows better. Barr essentially, in my view, had he been under oath, committed perjury in that presentation he made prior to the release of the redacted Mueller report. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly how he was lying. I mean, how blatant can you be when you say four times the Mueller report proved no collusion, when the Mueller report says explicitly, "I did not look at the broader question of collusion," which can involve all kinds of things. I only looked at the very narrow question of whether beyond a reasonable doubt I could establish the crime of conspiracy or coordination. And yet blatantly, in contradiction to that, Barr openly lies. Barr also openly lied when he said, "Oh, no, Mueller had no intention of, you know, putting this on Congress. It's my responsibility to interpret all this." No, Mueller says very explicitly in his report that while I didn't exonerate him, I didn't indict him, this is now a matter that Congress could take up. And how did they spin the presidential statement? "Oh, poor Donald Trump," you heard William Barr. "He was so frustrated. He was so upset because his enemies were after him and his enemies were illegally leaking." You know, he bends over backwards to absolve Donald Trump of what seems to me clear illegality and obstruction of justice. But somehow, without any evidence, there's illegal leaking going on. So that's how they're spinning it. But, you know, if we get an impeachment investigation, all of this can come out in a way that the American people are going to focus on and the American people are going to see. And by the way, the polls have actually moved more towards impeachment. They're now at about 40%. Think about that. Even before you have an inquiry, 40% of the American people want this president impeached. With an inquiry, that's going to go over 50. And that 40% is about comparable where the public stood at the beginning of the impeachment inquiry into Richard Nixon.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My great pleasure. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and studied both the American right and the presidency. And he's the author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment. And his latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an update on the fine print in the Mueller report.
Police and thieves in the street. Oh yes, scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. But the next generation will be, hear me, all the crimes committed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net. And he's a contributor to Motherboard, The New Republic, Al Jazeera, and others. And she's the author of Anatomy of Deceit, a primer on the CIA leak investigation, and live blog The Scooter Libby Trial. Marcy serves on the Advisory Committee of the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, and was declared an Internet Human Rights Hero by Access Now. And she has an article at emptywheel.net, The Significance of Trump's Obstruction of Investigation of His Family's Campaign Finance Crimes, Plural. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcy Wheeler.
Thanks for having me.
So Donald Trump has been one step ahead of the sheriff all his life, and he boasted, of course, that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. Do you think he's dodged a bullet with the way that Barr presented this Mueller report to the public? And so much of it, of course, has not been analyzed. You've looked at it all. A few other people have, but it doesn't seem to have penetrated the consciousness of the American people. How do you rate the possibility of the full weight of this report reaching the heartland of America, shall we say?
Well, I live in the heartland of America, so it reached me. I think, as you point out, Bill Barr, the Attorney General, did a tremendous job of spinning this report. But I think that may backfire. I think that a number of people, including a number of Republicans who believe in DOJ, are appalled at how dishonest his press conference was last Thursday. I mean, there are multiple things in there that just flat out conflict with what the report actually says. And then when you look closer, it's clear that he was trying to cover up some other things that the report said. So it's early yet. As I agree that most of my neighbors here in Michigan have not read the report, although I had an interaction with a farmer at the farmer's market the other day, and I said that I had been reading it, and she said, "How is it?" And I said, "It's really damning." And she, who I assume is a conservative, was really alarmed to hear that. I think that people will listen about what the content of the report is, and if it does get out, as people do read it, because it really does take a long time to get through and to process it, then we may see people begin to get more and more concerned.
Well, it looks as if the House are going to censure Barr. They've got the votes to do it, and I don't know what impact that will have. It certainly goes down in the historic record. You know, he has sort of a history of being a cleanup man. He was a cleanup man for George H.W. Bush and buried all of the Iran-Contra, pardoned Weinberg and others. So that seems to be his role in history. But there's still 14 investigations that have spun off from the Mueller investigation, 12 of which are secret. So where do you think this is heading in terms of, like, Adam Schiff is more or less saying, look, there's a lot more investigation to do, because, as you know, Marcy Wheeler, the I word is coming up a lot, impeachment. And I think a lot of Democrats are being put on the spot here.
Well, one thing that I've pointed out in another post at my site, emptywheel.net, is that the report is silent about the most alarming incidents of seeming coziness between Trump and Vladimir Putin. If you find a searchable copy of the report and you search for the word Helsinki, it doesn't show up at all. There's no mention of the fact that Trump spoke to Vladimir Putin twice when he was crafting the message about what happened at the June 9th meeting, and subsequently admitted that he and Putin had talked about precisely the topic of the statement that he wrote up about the June 9th meeting as that statement was being crafted. The report talks about the interview where that happened and somehow neglects to mention, oh, Trump also admitted that he talked to Putin without aides present about the subject of the statement about June 9th. And so that's a testament to the fact that the counterintelligence details of this investigation aren't in the report. There are a number of other places where that's clear, but the most obvious places is that the things we're most concerned about between Trump and Putin are not addressed in the report at all. And so that's one of the things that Adam Schiff is going to be learning in briefings and in coming days that you and I may not learn directly, but it may become more and more clear. One thing that is in the report, though, which is really fascinating, is that in June 2017, at precisely the time, by the way, that Trump was beginning to, that Trump's people at least were beginning to figure out how to anticipate the press response on the June 9th meeting, he was trying to fire Jeff Sessions. And one of the things, one of the demands he made on Jeff Sessions, which Sessions ended up not responding to, but he wanted Sessions to unrecuse and limit Mueller's investigation to future elections, which, first of all, doesn't even make sense. You can't investigate something that hasn't happened yet. But it's also a testament to the fact that in Trump's actions, in actions that Mueller deemed of significant interest on the question of obstruction, Trump did not just attempt to obstruct the investigation into him. He also attempted to obstruct the investigation into Russia's crimes. And that in and of itself, I think, is becoming a bigger takeaway as people read and think about the report more regularly. I mean, his job as president is to protect the United States. But he was not just trying to thwart an investigation into him personally, but also into Russia's efforts to help him get elected.
So that's why whatever went on in those conversations about the June meeting in Trump Tower with the Russians offering dirt on Hillary, and of course the cover story that developed was that it was really all about adoptions. So the real question would be, were Putin and Trump talking about adoptions or talking about dirt on Hillary? Trump, though, has never allowed a record of these conversations to emerge, and he wouldn't even let Fiona Hill and other Russian National Security Council people in to these meetings that he's had with Putin.
Right, precisely. Although one of the things we do learn in the report is that on January 28th, 2017, Trump and his national security staff, including Mike Flynn, but this is one of the reasons he didn't fire Mike Flynn right away, they all had a conference call with Vladimir Putin. And we learn in the report that the head of the Russian Development Fund and hedge fund buddy of Jared Kushner and George Nader, who's a convicted pedophile and has ties to all these Gulf oligarchs, they were literally strategizing that phone call, the January 28th, 2017 phone call, less than an hour before the phone call happened. So Trump was being advised by a hedge fund about issues. And then we also learned in the report that they discussed not just the things that the official readouts of the calls said, but they also discussed win-wins on investment strategies. And so those details are actually unbelievably damning. And that's an example of a conversation between Trump and Putin that he had, that detail that they had spoken about win-wins on investment, that's never been public before, but it makes the meeting and everything that led up to it and his refusal to fire Mike Flynn, it makes all of that far more damning.
Well, that the Dmitriev lure, if you will, that Putin sent out, he's the sovereign wealth guy, to hook up with the hedge fund guy that works with Jared Kushner, seems pretty clear. They know that these people are greedy, and we know that Kushner was underwater on 666 Fifth Avenue and was desperate for financing. So it's sort of rather like what's happening now with Trump making that extraordinary phone call to General Haftar, the warlord who's trying to take over Libya. And he controls the part of the Libya where the oil is. And you wonder, Trump did this against all the advice of the U.S. government, and yet he's, you know, making a deal with Haftar, and you can't help feeling that maybe there's some oil trades going on in the background there.
Right, and one thing it's important for listeners to know about the report, it was fairly narrowly scoped. So the judgments, the Mueller judgment saying that the investigation did not establish that anyone from Trump conspired with the Russian government, that in and of itself, they say, you know, the comment that we did not establish does not mean there was not evidence. You know, it's clear there was evidence showing there may have been a conspiracy, just not evidence that it could be charged. But in a few key points, particularly when Mueller is talking about his analysis of the transition meetings, the denial of any crime is again limited to election interference. And the crimes that we might expect Trump and Jared Kushner, especially, although I should say, the report states pretty clearly that there's no evidence that RDIF did pay off the 666 fund, the 666 Fifth Avenue. So, but the Jared stuff and the Seychelles meeting and a bunch of other things that were going on during the transition, that stuff is all graft. That stuff has nothing to do with the election interference. It has to do with a bunch of oligarchs trying to rub each other's back. And Mueller's denials of any crime clearly do not include that kind of graft. And we know, for example, that some of that graft is what has been spun off into other investigations. So we know, for example, that Southern District of New York, either on their own or also with some referrals from Mueller, is investigating inauguration fund graft. And so that's the kind of thing that clearly would not be included in any exonerating language from this report.
And again, I'm speaking with Marcy Wheeler, who's an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net. She's a contributor to Motherboard, The New Republic, and Al Jazeera, and she's the author of Anatomy of Deceit, and she serves on the Advisory Committee of the House Fourth Amendment Caucus, and is a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, and was declared an Internet Human Rights Hero by Access Now, and has an article at emptywheel.net, The Significance of Trump's Obstruction of Investigation of His Family's Campaign Finance Crimes, plural. And of course, in these attempts to set up back channels, you mentioned George Nader. Of all the people to choose as your secret interlocutor, a convicted child molester, it's pretty breathtaking. And of course, we're learning now that Eric Prince offered himself up as a back channel as well. But the Russians apparently thought Eric Prince was too dumb for the job. So this is a pretty motley bunch of bottom feeders, I have to say. What about this other thread, though? I mean, when they say no collusion, no collusion, and Trump's, that's his, been his mantra, it's kind of clever on his part because it's not even a legal term, collusion, but he keeps doing that. But there's clear collusion in the report between Manafort and Konstantin Kilimnik and sending all that polling data to the Russians so that the troll farm run by Prigozhin could then target those three states where Trump won the elections, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Why do you think Mueller backed off on that one?
Well, he's quite clear that he could not charge it because he was never able to figure out what was going on. And that was due to a couple of things. One is that Manafort kept lying about it. And another one is that some of the key communications, presumably involving Kalimnik, were encrypted, and they haven't been able to break the encryption on them. So in that case, the obstruction worked. It's not clear. We can't say that that was clearly some conspiracy, but we can say that Manafort's obstruction of the investigation prevented Mueller from determining whether a conspiracy happened or not.
Well,
and that's important because Manafort is one of the people that Trump basically has floated a pardon to. So float a pardon, get Manafort to remain silent or to lie, basically outright lie. The judge already ruled that that happened. And in the process, prevent Mueller from being able to basically find the evidence of any conspiracy that happened.
Well, it's pretty clear that the GRU had a conduit through Kalimnik. But apparently there's another conduit of the FSB's to Manafort via Dmitry Symes, who, of course, wrote the platform for the Republican convention, which was altered to make it more Russia-friendly. I don't know, did Dmitry Symes skip town, or is he still in Washington? I mean, he has quite a long background in having run the Nixon Institute, et cetera. Have you followed?
I believe he's still in town, and I think he actually cooperated in the investigation. And that's another area, particularly the change in the platform, where Mueller did not establish that there was anything funny going on. And I think that's fairly compelling. I think that was fairly clear ahead of time. With regards to Symes, there's extensive analysis of whether Symes was kind of a back channel for the Russians. And the language there, as it is in some other places, basically says we did not establish evidence to support that. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means they didn't find any evidence to it. And I think there are a couple of other instances where they probably suspected there was a tie and just weren't able to substantiate it.
So do you share the opinion that somehow Mueller got rolled by Barr?
I don't know that he got rolled by Barr. I don't think Barr forced Mueller to end the investigation early. And it's important to note the prosecutors at least claim that the investigation into both Stone and Manafort continues. So we may see other stuff relating to them. Mueller, I guess, doesn't expect it to relate to Russia, but just the Russian government. I mean, it may be, for example, that we see something more extensive about WikiLeaks and Roger Stone. In the back of the report, there's the questions that Mueller posed to Trump, which for the most part, Trump just answered by saying, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall. I mean, it's pretty contemptuous. And the notion that Barr claimed that Trump fully cooperated, if you look at those answers, it's just ridiculous that he even tried to make that claim. But one of the questions that I did not expect in there is whether Trump had any discussions about pardoning Julian Assange before he was inaugurated. We know that for the entirety of 2017 going into 2018, there were a series of efforts to get him to pardon Assange, all of which ultimately failed. But knowing, or at least seeing that Mueller seems to think that those pardon discussions started earlier is actually really interesting, because that's not something we've seen in the existing paperwork, but it is something that I expect may show up in the Julian Assange prosecution, because he was trying to use these CIA hacking tools to basically coerce a pardon. So who knows where that'll go, but that's an interesting thread that really hasn't been chased down. And I expect that WikiLeaks probably is one of the referrals that gets listed in the appendix there as well.
Well, we know that that's probably the real reason why they want Assange over here, because the CIA is furious about the Vault 7 leak and WikiLeaks publication of it. But just in the last minute or so, Marcy Wheeler, of course, we mentioned earlier how it was clever of the Republicans. They've so far been able to corral this report and to some extent put the Democrats on the defensive, and the Democrats themselves are wringing their hands over whether or not to impeach. And, of course, if you do nothing and roll over, then you're effectively accepting Trump's narrative that this was no big deal, no collusion. You know, so to some extent, the Republicans have put the Democrats on a spot. You know, they
right. And one really important thing for listeners is Trump from day one has called this investigation an investigation into collusion. On March 20th, 2017, Jim Comey made it very clear that's not what the investigation was about. They were pursuing conspiracy. The difference is important because conspiracy is a legal term. Collusion is not. Collusion sort of refers to cooperation between these two entities. And in the language that Barr used to refer to Roger Stone, and that the redacted bits talking about why they didn't charge Roger Stone with something else, there's basically the argument that because Roger Stone was optimizing the release of emails from WikiLeaks, because of First Amendment considerations, that's not a crime. And so whereas it is true that Roger Stone was not charged with conspiring with WikiLeaks and through them with Russia, it is also true that what he did by optimizing the release of the emails is by any definition collusion. And so this game, and there's actually even a passage in the report, two of them, where Mueller says, this report is not about collusion, it's about conspiracy. So the game in which Trump is playing by saying there's no collusion is actually claiming the report said something far broader than it did. It only spoke about whether anything got legally charged. And it even said that both in the June 9th meeting and in the Roger Stone thing, on the June 9th thing, Mueller basically said, yes, I think a crime happened, but I don't think I can charge it because I don't think I can win prosecution on it. So even there, Trump is claiming that the report offers far more exoneration than it actually does.
Well, specifically in your article, Marcy, you say you have, I guess, the index from the report, see Russia government outreach and contacts, and number one, potential coordination, conspiracy, and collusion. Well, let's take coordination. I mean, how much more coordination could be more obvious than the fact that within less than an hour of the Access Hollywood tape coming out just before the election, where Trump boasts about being able to grab women by the private parts and get away with it because he's a celebrity, suddenly, with almost like a half an hour later, WikiLeaks dumps another trench of incriminating documents from Podesta's hack. So that does certainly look like coordination, doesn't it?
Right. And the report is, at least in the unredacted parts of the report, is uncommittal about how that happened. It does seem that Jerome Corsi was overplaying his own role in that, but at several times during Jerome Corsi's alleged cooperation with the government, it seems that he was overstating his role effectively to provide Stone cover. So the report seems to indicate that there's no evidence Corsi had a role in getting those emails dropped early, held until the Access Hollywood thing came out. But we don't know what it says about Stone because that's all redacted.
Sure. Well, just in closing, the one thing that we should make clear here is that the winner so far in terms of the money race is Donald Trump. Apparently, money is pouring in to his re-election campaign. So stay tuned. I thank you for joining us, Marcy Wheeler.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcy Wheeler, who's an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net and is a contributor to Motherboard, The New Republic, and Al Jazeera. She's the author of Anatomy of Deceit and serves on the Advisory Committee of the House Fourth Amendment Caucus and is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security and was declared an internet human rights hero by Access Now. And she has an article at emptywheel.net, The Significance of Trump's Obstruction of Investigations of His Family Campaign Finance Crimes, plural. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the links to foreign terrorist networks emerging from the suicide bombing attacks in Sri Lanka. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. His books include India Since 1980, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you, Sumit. And the Sri Lankan government, at least a spokesperson for the cabinet, is now saying that the bombings that killed close to 300 and wounded over 500, the bombings were carried out by a little-known group called the National Tawheed Jamaath. And apparently the warnings that this might well happen were not passed on to the Prime Minister or his cabinet. So what do you make of that? Is there some sort of people covering their behinds, or what's going on, do you think?
No, I think this simply was an organizational failure. Mm-hmm. It is hardly unknown. These things have happened in the past elsewhere in the world. And also, I suspect the warnings were of a generalized nature, that yes, there is the possibility of an impending terrorist attack and possibly even a suicide terrorist attack. But it is possible that specific targets might not have been made known. It has been revealed already that the warnings came from Indian intelligence, and one of the targets apparently was the Indian High Commission. That was actually identified. It is not clear if the Roman Catholic churches had also been identified and if the various hotels had been identified. But clearly this strike has all the hallmarks of an organizational failure where one branch of government fails to talk to another branch.
Well, the spokesperson for Sri Lanka's government's cabinet said, we do not believe these attacks were carried out by a group of people who were confined to this country. There was an international network without which these attacks could not have succeeded. So what do we know about the possibilities of links to other foreign terrorist organizations?
It sounds plausible for the simple reason of the sheer complexity of the attacks and the scale of the attacks. The group that has been identified as the likely perpetrators, at the most they had ever done before in the past was to deface some Buddhist statues. And to go from defacing a statue, which could be virtually a college prank of that order, to leaping to a coordinated terrorist attack across various places in the country at major hotels, and also other locations suggests something of a much higher order that this group on its own might not have the capability to have carried it out.
Well, the assumption is that somehow this group are associated with a group of Muslim youths in Sri Lanka who were radicalized after clashes that took place last year in the Kandy district between the majority Buddhist Sinhalese and the minority Muslims. So the strange part about it is that if this was retribution for a Buddhist attack on Muslims, why then were the attackers, why did they target Christians?
That is precisely a question that I've been puzzling over since the news of the attacks broke, because several people have suggested that there has been a rise of Buddhist Sinhala chauvinism. And while I believe that is indeed the case, then the attack should have been directed against Buddhist temples and Buddhist sites. Why attack Christians? So it's clearly not in retaliation against the rise and the misbehavior of some elements of the Buddhist community. Then the targets should have been prominent Buddhist temples, prominent Buddhist religious sites of pilgrimage, of which there is no end in Sri Lanka. Why single out a minuscule minority on the holiest days or amongst the holiest days of the year while they are at religious services and take your wrath out against them? One allegation I have heard is that this group was motivated by the attack on the mosque in New Zealand about a month ago. And that strikes me as being a much more plausible reason rather than hatred or revenge against radical Buddhist activists.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. And he's the author of India Since 1980. And his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. So when you talk about religious chauvinism, the New York Times is carrying a story on Monday saying that to some extent we know that there's a global rise of religious intolerance in Indonesia, which had previously been fairly moderate in terms of its religiosity. But the article sort of singled out Modi, the Prime Minister of India, who's in the campaign mode, and he's using religious chauvinism and Hindu nationalism to rally his base. Is there anything to those charges?
Oh, there's no question about it that Modi has long nodded and winked at Hindu chauvinists in India. And in this campaign, though he himself has not personally participated in such scapegoating, a number of members of his party have not shied away from it. And Hindu chauvinism is very much a live issue in the current election in India. But I would be loath to link that with the developments in Sri Lanka. I think that's a bit of a stretch until we get more information that gives us an inkling that the two are somehow organically related. It is possible that the rise of Hindu chauvinism could be generating a backlash in Sri Lanka amongst Muslims, but surely that cannot be the cause for this highly orchestrated and carefully organized attack and on multiple churches. Then why not attack Hindus? And there's no dearth of Hindu temples in Sri Lanka that could have been attacked. And so the connection that if the Times has hinted at that there might be some link between Modi's Hindu chauvinism and these developments in Sri Lanka, I find the connection awfully tenuous.
Well, there certainly were Western tourists were targeted. 31 foreign nationals died, and there are still 14 unaccounted for. And they do seem to have rounded up a bunch of people and found a bunch of explosives. And there was even a rather large explosive device that was 6 feet long, plastic pipe, black with explosives. That was found near the airport in Colombo, and 87 detonators were found. So it sounds like, again, the theory that there was some foreign help, and I imagine people are thinking of the Islamic State or somebody like that, in terms of getting all of those that equipment in to the country. So that seems fairly plausible. What's your sense of how you mentioned earlier, Sumit, that Indian intelligence, the RAW, told the Sri Lankans about this? Was that the report that was ignored?
That is precisely the report that was ignored and not acted upon. The evidence that Indian intelligence had passed on information about an impending attack now is pretty firm. That has been confirmed by a number of different sources. And from the description that you just provided and information that I'm also privy to suggests the distinct possibility of an external group's involvement in this tragic set of events.
So you were recently in Sri Lanka at one of the hotels that was attacked. Were you in that buffet breakfast line?
I was thinking about that, and I was not in the buffet breakfast line because I was on one of the more privileged floors where the breakfast is actually served on your floor. So I did not have to go to the breakfast line, but I was very much in that hotel. And when this happened, I wrote to a Sri Lankan friend that there, but for the grace of God, go I, because when I was there and checked into the hotel, there was virtually no security in the entranceway, and there was a massive wedding that was taking place in the central auditorium-like area in the hotel. And had this taken place about a year and a half ago, I very well could have been amongst the victims.
So this country, of course, Sri Lanka, has had a long and painful civil war where the Tamil Tigers were essentially defeated. Has there been reconciliation? Are there any vestiges of retribution there in the country?
There's still vestiges of resentment and unhappiness and disenchantment amongst the Tamil community, because not enough has been done to redress their sense of grievance. Though I do not see that LTT, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, the principal terrorist organization that was fighting for a separate state, I have not seen any evidence of them regrouping any time in the recent past. There have been no reports to that end, so it's hard to imagine how they might have been involved in these recent developments, despite the existence of simmering discontent within the Tamil community about the grievances that had existed in the first place and the poor quality of redressal of those grievances.
So how important is tourism to the economy of Sri Lanka?
I do not have figures at my fingertips, but on the other hand, I can tell you that it is of enormous significance. And when I had gone to Sri Lanka about 3 years ago as a tourist and stayed in one of the Tonier resorts, it was more than evident that the service industry was clearly geared up to handle high-end tourism from people like myself in the United States, who were prepared to pay a fair amount of money to stay in very comfortable and indeed luxurious circumstances. And there was a great deal of enthusiasm that tourism was coming back. It was quite palpable when I was there for well over a week in Sri Lanka.
Well, of course, one of the tragedies or the victims that has got a lot of prominence have been the three children of a Danish billionaire, Anders Poulsen, were killed, and the mother and two children belonging to a couple of British lawyers as well were blown up. So it was a particularly grim thing. And, of course, nothing is – if this is retaliation for New Zealand – the video that shooter in New Zealand took from his helmet camera apparently is the most terrific thing that anybody could possibly see. And it was used by the president of Turkey, Erdogan, in campaign rallies to rile up his
supporters,
which is pretty despicable on his part. So one wonders whether that kind of video is out there radicalizing people with a lust for vengeance.
It's entirely possible, and we will hopefully find out more in the weeks and months ahead. But there is no gainsaying the extent of the tragedy that has befallen Sri Lanka. After 10 years of a brutal and sanguinary civil war, this is the last thing the country needed. It has enough other problems of its own without this new potential ethnic and religious divide, quite apart from the colossal loss of life.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, I wanted to turn to the elections in India, and we mentioned Modi whipping up his Hindu nationalist base with a sort of coded dog whistle religious messages. How are the Muslim communities feeling? I've read reports that in India, Muslims don't like sort of wandering around at night on their own, that there's a sense that mob violence is looming in the background.
Amongst some Muslims, particularly Muslims who are poor There's a deep sense of distrust and indeed a sense of palpable fear, particularly around the time of an election when passions can run high and there is the potential for violence. But even amongst Muslims who are upper middle class and who are more obviously more prosperous, there is a palpable sense of distrust, a palpable sense of unease, and a sense that they are virtually becoming second-class citizens in India's democracy, which to me is a colossal tragedy.
But nevertheless, you think Modi's going to be re-elected or get a bigger majority?
It is extremely difficult to predict how the Indian electorate will behave, because the Indian electorate has become quite sophisticated and public opinion polls are not always the most reliable indicators before the elections. The public opinion polls seem to suggest that Modi will lose a substantial number of seats, but ultimately will at least emerge with a plurality in parliament and thereby be able to cobble together a coalition to come back to power again. But once again, I would strike a cautionary note, because ultimately Indian elections are not national referendums usually, and instead they focus upon any number of local and regional issues, and consequently we may not see another Modi wave as one saw in 2016, when there was a perception that the Congress Party was not only the ruling party, the Congress Party was not only corrupt but utterly inept, that it could not get anything done, and a leader who promised to be decisive, who had clear plans and a clear set of goals, seemed preferable. But much of that sheen has come off Modi, and consequently, I doubt that he can generate the same sort of support that he had garnered in 2016. And his appeal to Hindu chauvinism will hold in only particular parts of India, and it is not likely to have a nationwide appeal. And consequently, I am a little bit cautious about predicting a clear-cut victory for Modi.
Well, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian, for this opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. He's the author of India Since 1980, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.